selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a una atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group.
And coming at you next, it's the Bathrop Spears Broadside Show of August 10th, 2023, which is a flashback, pretty much, to the November 27th, 2014 show, 9 years ago. I'm also going to be playing for you initially a sort of a educational 20 minutes of analysis of homeless services funding in Santa Cruz, where it comes from, where it goes, by the Santa Cruz local gang, who I don't really know much about, except I'm always suspicious of even so-called alternative news sources, perhaps unduly so and perhaps unjustifiably so. You can judge for yourself to some extent by listening to their podcast analysis, which comes after apparently they did some research, 100 interviews or so they say, and created three different documents, which you can find by going to santacruzlocal.org and then going down to the right side of their screen to popular stories and then clicking on podcast, How Homeless Services Money is Spent in Santa Cruz County. And you can actually, you can hear this, well, you'll be hearing the same podcast in just a moment after the traditional introductory music that we play for Bathrop Spears Broadsides from Pins and Needles, Sing Me a Song of Social Significance. But you also can find, if you click on that, access to the three documents that make up the summary of their research and what they found and why they have concluded what you will hear them talking about on this podcast, which will follow immediately after the introductory music. So then you get to hear as much as we could recover of the flashback from November 27, 2014, me crouching at City Council and the Robinson Council. That was, she was the mayor at that time, Mayor Robinson, who was very insistent that I not be allowed to place my recorder at the dais where I usually did and do and have ever since, if and when I get to city council meetings, and record leaving it on because she said it was unattended and therefore it was a violation of the rules, she decided. And actually, that was a rule created long ago by an old protagonist of mine, Tim Fitzmaurice, when he was mayor, who came in as a so-called liberal and progressive on homeless issues, or masquerading as that, or perhaps thinking he was that, and then ended up essentially being the opposite, or at least backing away from his campaign promises to end the sleeping ban and so forth. But in any case, his restrictive rules continued, and he had these rules which this mayor actually enforced and had me arrested at least once. But, of course, I continued doing what I was doing, and no charges were ever filed, and it was just exhausting. But, hey, sometimes you got to put in an extra energy to cross the, I don't know if I'd call it the finish line, but I did keep recording, and I guess, I don't know if anyone else has ever had that much interest in city council meetings over the long run, but it's theoretically the area where the public is supposed to be able to meet those in power ruling the use of their monies, and that's, of course, that's the theory, but it's not the practice, in my view. However, let's get into the show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And truthfully, there's not going to be much singing in this show. This flashback is mostly speech, protests, Black Lives Matter, protests from the George Floyd killing. As I mentioned before, city council and the stay-away ordinance that was voted that allows the police to, on their own initiative, issue stay-away orders even before someone is taken to court and even tried, much less convicted of a crime, let's say, of trespass or some criminal behavior that might actually justify a judicial stay-away order. This was, again, part of one of the anti-homeless laws passed by city council to give police greater powers to drive away, intimidate, and bully homeless folks away rather than really address the needs and the realities of the homeless situation insofar as it continues in Santa Cruz to this day and is, of course, gotten more intense and more difficult for folks outside and, of course, for those poor middle-class people who have to see them every day and worry that their children might be eaten by them. Anyway, here we go into the podcast, How Homeless Services Money is Spent in Santa Cruz County. This is by Stephen Baxter, August 2nd, 2023. And again, it kind of summarizes or addresses three earlier articles, How Homeless Services Money Has Been Spent in Santa Cruz County, Money Sources, Constraints, and Problems with Homeless Services Spending in Santa Cruz County, and Is Homeless Services Spending Effective in Santa Cruz County?
I'm Stephen Baxter.
And I'm Kara Myberg-Guzman.
This is Santa Cruz Local. Santa Cruz Local recently published a three-part investigation. We looked at how public money has been spent on homeless services in Santa Cruz County. This spending breakdown had never been shown before in a comprehensive way. Today, we're going to walk you through what we found and why it matters. Kara, can you tell us why Santa Cruz Local started looking into homeless services spending in the first place?
Sure. So we really want our investigations to be tuned to the questions of Santa Cruz County residents. In fall of 2021, we interviewed about 120 residents, both housed and unhoused, and we asked, What are your questions, concerns, and priorities around homelessness? Basically, what do you want us to dig into? By far, the top theme we heard was that people want solutions to homelessness. Another theme we heard was, please follow the money. How are my tax dollars being spent on homeless services in our county? I was surprised about how much this question, you know, how is public money spent on homeless services, how much that resonated with so many residents in our county. We recently hosted an event at our headquarters in downtown Santa Cruz. You know, we talked about our investigation and what we found, and the event was at capacity. There were many people who joined online. There were so many people who deeply cared about this question and wanted to know more.
What were some of the big takeaways from the reporting?
Yeah, the first big takeaway is that there is no comprehensive system to track how public money is spent on homeless services in our county. There isn't one central dashboard where you can look up, you know, all the different state, local, and federal sources and how that money is being spent. The second big takeaway is that at the start of the COVID pandemic in 2020, spending on homeless services about tripled, but the net number of homeless people stayed about constant. So despite a huge increase in spending in homeless services at the start of the pandemic, the net number of homeless people in our county stayed pretty much the same.
Right. Or it stayed the same because of all that spending, you could argue.
Yeah, for sure. There were people getting housed, you know, finding housing during the pandemic. But the rate of people who are returning to homelessness or becoming homeless, you know, pretty much canceled that out.
We should talk a little bit about how homeless services are funded in Santa Cruz County.
Sure. So in Santa Cruz County, homeless services depends on state and federal dollars. In our county, we have this agency called the Housing for Health Partnership. It's also known as the Continuum of Care. Each county in our state has a continuum of care. It is a federally designated body that coordinates all the programs and services centered on preventing and ending homelessness. Besides the continuum of care, the local jurisdictions like the City of Santa Cruz, the City of Watsonville, the County of Santa Cruz, those jurisdictions also receive and administer grants related to homeless services in our county.
So explain to our readers exactly how we found out how much money was spent on these things.
So because there is no central database or dashboard that tracks public spending on homeless services, we had to go find that ourselves. So what that meant was a ton of Public Records Act requests. We filed requests with the City of Santa Cruz, City of Watsonville, City of Scotts Valley, Capitola, the County of Santa Cruz, and asked how much money was spent in fiscal years 2019-2020 and fiscal year 2020-2021 on homeless services. What was it spent on, and when was it spent? In return, we got thousands of pages of grant documents, board memos, budgets, agenda packets, you know, other documents, and we combed through every single document to look for line items of spending. So we created this giant spreadsheet that tracked how much money was spent in each fiscal year and on what homeless services exactly. the budget, the documents were not straightforward. For example, you know, a board memo might not, oftentimes was not exactly clear on, you know, exactly what was spent in which year. So this entailed many months of follow-up questions with county leaders and city leaders. So once all of our reporting was fact-checked and we made sure it was accurate, then we created these infographics, these charts that showed by category how much was spent on homeless services in each local jurisdiction and in each fiscal year.
Tell us more about what the charts showed.
The first thing I'll say is that you can follow along. We'll put a link in the show notes to the series with the charts. They're on our website at santacruzlocal.org. But so these charts, I think the first big takeaway from these charts, like I said, is that homeless services spending more than tripled from 2019 to 2021. You know, of course, the backdrop of this time period is the start of the COVID pandemic. There were tens of millions of dollars of more money available during the pandemic for homeless services. From July 2019 through June 2020, at least $31.3 million was spent in our county on homeless services. The following fiscal year, it was $95.6 million at least spent on homeless services in our county. The largest spending category by far was temporary shelters. Nearly $52 million was spent over those 2 years on temporary shelter. The second largest category was rental assistance. At least $36.23 million was spent in our county on rent assistance during those two fiscal years.
The charts also showed some other categories. Permanent housing development was one. The Homeless Persons Health Project was another, case management, and some mental health services. But there were some caveats to the data that we found. Can you tell us more about that?
For sure. A thing to know about these charts is that it only includes public money. A lot of homeless services in our county are carried out by nonprofit groups. They have other sources of money besides local, state, and federal grants. You know, for example, they get money from individual donors, other, you know, private grant programs. That money was not included in our charts. Another thing to note is that public spending on mental health was largely not included in our charts. So the County of Santa Cruz has behavioral health programs that for sure treat many homeless people in our county, but we did not include that county behavioral health program spending in our charts because in their expense reports, they don't, in their budgeting, they don't really, you know, delineate which of their clients, you know, how much was spent on homeless clients versus housed clients. So we did not include the roughly $80 million per year that's spent by our county on behavioral health services. So Stephen, let's turn it to you. I'd love to hear what are your big takeaways from our investigation.
We had four big takeaways from our reporting, and the first one is easily the most important. We mentioned it before. This information about how money was spent on homeless services just hasn't been publicly available before. There hasn't been this overarching view of how the money has been spent, and it hasn't been as transparent as it could have been. One person we spoke to during the reporting was Rainey Perez. Rainey was the County of Santa Cruz's homeless services coordinator from 2016 to August 2021.
The public has a right to know how the money is spent. I think that the county would be very hard-pressed to demonstrate outcomes because without the proper tracking systems, you can't. If you can't even track the expenditures in a systemic way, I think it would be hard to track outcomes in a systemic way. I think they could do it on a contract by contract basis. You know, this contract achieved these outcomes, but I don't know how else they could describe it.
You can't manage what you don't measure. So how could the public understand what's working and what's not if we don't track it in this way? And this transparency, it's achievable, and it's been planned by county leaders. In 2021, the county leaders started this 3-year strategic framework to address homelessness, and in it included an online data dashboard. And they said at the time that this dashboard could track things like the number of shelter beds provided by various agencies, or how many homes have been built for low-income households, and what's the time it takes for a person to get from a temporary shelter to a permanent home. So it wasn't necessarily money tracking, but it might maybe could be outcome tracking in a more accountable way. So this dashboard has not come to fruition. We're in the middle of 2023. Now, since our series on homeless services spending was published this spring, the county's Housing for Health partnership met on June 21st in Capitola. And the partnership, you remember, coordinates and receives all that money from federal and state government to provide all these homeless services in our county. During that meeting, Dr. Robert Ratner talked about what a Santa Cruz County homeless services dashboard could look like. Ratner is the director of the county's Housing for Health division. He's essentially in charge of homeless services in the county. He's also a physician. He talked about some public dashboards that the state maintains. The dashboard that Ratner is talking about contains some information from Santa Cruz County about the race, age, gender, and number of people who accessed homeless services. It does not contain information about money spent on homeless services or the categories of those homeless services. Ratner said that a dashboard in public health is supposed to be like a dashboard in a car. It's meant to provide a small amount of information to make quick decisions. It's a little different than what Santa Cruz Local produced and what Rainey Perez described, which is a more detailed tracking system of homeless services spending and potentially outcomes of that spending.
So I personally thought there's got to be some balancing of what are the things we actually think are really critical to share that are going to give people a sense that other things are happening versus just overwhelming the data and the continuing narrative that this isn't going to change.
Here's the second takeaway from our investigation into homeless services spending. There is a tension between short-term goals and long-term goals. A short-term strategy is to open temporary shelters around the city of Santa Cruz. A long-term strategy is building, say, hundreds of units of permanent supportive housing around the county. Coral Street would be one area for that. Other longer-term strategies could involve landlord recruitment or building more housing. A lot of time is spent on the short-term policies. They address the most visible parts of homelessness in our county. An example would be dealing with a tent camp in San Lorenzo Park. There are a lot of competing needs and limited money to try to meet those needs. Our third takeaway, goals don't drive homeless services. Grant money does. Here's Rainey Perez again. She's the former homeless services coordinator for the county.
What I would say is, to some extent, the fact that we chase the money that's made available means we do what the money's made available to do. And in an ideal world, and it would be the other way around, we would design what we want to do, and then we would apply for those funds to do specifically what we want to do. But that's not typically how funding is made available. When you have nothing and you have an opportunity to apply for something, go after it. I think it's irresponsible for a community to have a profound homelessness problem and not go after every homeless dollar that they can bring in.
The grant money is usually for specific purposes with deadlines to spend the money, like a grant for youth services or hotel rooms during the pandemic. What matters is what state and federal grants can be applied for and won. The grants are usually one time, not ongoing. So local leaders have all these plans to address homelessness, Because homeless services are dependent on state and federal grants, those plans might not get funding. The last takeaway, there is a maze of bureaucracy related to homeless services spending. The whole state and federal systems of grant making to try to address homelessness is pretty convoluted. There are more than 40 sources of money. The county leaders are trying to get at all of it. It all requires applications, grant management, and grant reporting. All that paperwork takes away from the direct work with unhoused people. And this is frustrating to county staff. Here's Robert Ratner again.
Each funding source has different rules and different contracts and levels of staff support on the end of the funding agency that can help us understand the rules, etc. There's different start and end dates and deadlines and reporting requirements and reporting systems. So we spend a lot of our time as staff navigating and braiding this funding together to try to get outcomes. It's a lot of wasted taxpayer dollars, to be honest with you. The amount of time I spend, the amount of time my coworkers spend, and all of this work, we'd rather be helping people move into housing. So the extent that the federal and state government can make it easier and consistent with the funding that we receive and be more predictable, we can have a much bigger impact on our communities.
Since we published our series this spring, a lot of people have asked us, what could the county be doing better to address homelessness? And we found some of that in our reporting, too. Kara, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I would suggest listeners go back in your podcast feed and listen to our earlier episode called How Santa Cruz County Could Solve Chronic Homelessness. We looked at Bakersfield and Kern County, which achieved functional zero in chronic homelessness. And the big takeaway there, what they did was they aligned all the homeless service providers in the county towards a shared goal of actually solving chronic homelessness. They built a really nimble operation to get people out of chronic homelessness quickly. In our county, we're moving towards a shared goal of housing, but we're not all the way there yet. Not all homeless service providers and local jurisdictions are on the same page. The other thing is that Bakersfield's operation is a lot smoother. We've heard from a lot of unhoused people here in our county that it's really hard to navigate the system. It is not user-friendly. It takes a long time for to sign up for things like housing vouchers, getting an ID, or, you know, accessing food services.
Another common question we heard was, what can I do to help the homeless situation in Santa Cruz County?
Yeah, there's a lot of homeless service providers in our county, and a lot of them are looking for volunteers and donations. There's groups like the Community Action Board that does a lot of work in South County. You know, there's Housing Matters in the city of Santa Cruz. Reach out and see how you could help. If you're interested in providing housing, county leaders are always recruiting landlords who are willing to rent to people with housing vouchers. There's been a shortage of landlords in recent years, so you could reach out to the housing authority and let them know that you're interested. Another powerful thing you can do is join the Housing for Health Partnership. That's the federally designated agency that we mentioned. It helps coordinate state and federal dollars that are spent on homeless services. You can join and, you know, work on committees that are working to prevent and end homelessness in our county. I would also recommend reach out to your city council member, reach out to your county supervisor. Let them know that preventing and solving homelessness is important to you.
Another thing I'd recommend is this book called The Book on Ending Homelessness. It's by Ian DeJong, and it's useful because it provides something like a blueprint of what has worked and what has not worked in homeless services throughout the U.S. and Canada. So it's empowering, it's great, you should read it. You can read our three-part investigation on homeless services spending in Santa Cruz County at santacruzlocal.org. Links to those stories are in our show notes. If you find our work useful, please donate. Our Solutions to Homelessness series was funded in part by $30,000 in donations in 2021. It cost a lot more than that to produce. Please donate or become a member today. You can do that at santacruzlocal.org. And if you're not on our free weekly email newsletter list, join it. You can also find that at santacruzlocal.org. Thank you to our highest level members, Deborah Seche, Fran Goodwin, Chris Necklason, Elizabeth and David Doolin, and Patrick Riley. I'm Stephen Baxter. Thanks for listening to Santa Cruz Local.
And comes now the November 27th, 2014 flashback. Me, Doc Mike, and Katie, I think her name is, are emceeing various topics. The Black Lives Matter protests in the wake of the Ferguson verdict, freeing the murderer of George Floyd, busking laws in Santa Cruz with a guy who likes them, the guy who likes the way street performers are treated, and some of us like me who does not or didn't at the time. And then there's a jump ahead to the November 18th, 2014 Santa Cruz City Council, where I was sort of hovering next to my recorder. These are in the days when the mayor wanted to arrest me for not sitting next to my recorder because I left it unattended. I know it may sound a little strange, and it's, of course, ridiculous. It was a law designed specifically, I think, to penalize me, actually, because I was an activist who showed up regularly and criticized the city council fundamentally from a variety of different angles, mostly around the misuse of funds when it was quite clear that they were working on funneling their money into police harassment of homeless people as their solution to dealing with eliminating the homeless problem, or perhaps, as Hitler might have put it, the Jewish question. You know, it's a question, it's a problem. When the problem really is the stupidity, insensitivity, and the futility of the kinds of solutions that are being used toward poor people. But, of course, this is traditionally the way it is, where people are in an upper class. They somehow think they can do what they want. And, of course, until people stand up and say they can't, they do and will and continue to do what they want. Anyway, if you want to listen, listen on. Here it comes. Remember any numbers that you hear put out, and I don't think there's that much of that going on, are probably out of date. So enjoy it as a relic of another era, but also as a sort of a warning and a lesson to us, and maybe an inspiration too, because there were some people on the streets doing stuff then in ways that they are not doing now. Listen on.
got a book of rules that says I ain't got the right to be who owns the land.
Turkey Day to all you folks out there. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. And it's, a show that's starting 15 minutes late. So, good evening. I'm a little sleepy because I just got up from a nap here. Spent the afternoon, some of it, at the Veterans Hall Homeless Day Thanksgiving homeless meal on Thanksgiving Day. And, not a lot to report from that. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, typically, and today was no exception, has a table at the Veterans Hall. Though this is the first time the Veterans Hall has been open in 4 or 5 years. I think it's 5 years. I think 2009 was the last time the county brainiacs allowed the Veterans Hall to actually open up, in spite of the demands of the veterans, their engineers, and so forth, that the so-called architectural problems that the hall had were not in any way involving life-sustaining difficulty. There was some suspicion that this was a punitive operation from the brain of Tim Bratton, but I don't have any clear evidence on that that provides the smoking gun. Bratton was a character who wanted to use the Veterans Hall for other purposes than for veterans and their allies, profit-making activity, yoga classes, and things of that sort. Anyway, there was a line. At least 800 people got served, according to Elmo, one of the servers who came out, and even I got a plate of turkey and cranberry and stuffing and Brussels sprouts. Ooh, I hate Brussels sprouts. I can't stand them. But there were many different kinds of pastries for those who like pastries, and I like pastries. But that was the Thanksgiving meal. A lot of people were in line. A couple of security guards were standing around. A lot of relatively free interaction between people on the sidewalk, and you wouldn't normally find that in front of the Veterans Hall on an average day. nor would you find security guards there on an average day. When crowds of people, homeless people or otherwise, get together, it becomes more likely that people will use the sidewalk in the fashion for which it was intended. You know, you want to sit down, you sit down. You want to bounce a ball on the sidewalk, although I didn't see any ball bouncing today. You can do that. All these things are illegal on almost all the sidewalk up and down Pacific Avenue and the side streets, and indeed in all business districts in Santa Cruz. You know, didn't see any panhandling, actually, interestingly enough, though I did get one individual who had a panhandling ticket. Didn't stay long, and I had a guest who was going to come on the show, but I'm late, and I may have missed him, or he just may have decided to go elsewhere. It is Thanksgiving, after all, and I mean, who wants to stalk through a not quite frosty but nippy evening to come to a radio show that probably few people are listening to? Although, I don't know, maybe people are perhaps crowded around the radio. You never can tell. Just waiting for my show to come on. So in the studio with me, I have those two experts from the street. Well, at least one expert from the street. Dr. Mike, who has his own show still, I believe. Do you, Dr. Mike? You better get closer to the mic, Mike. Otherwise, people won't be able to hear you.
Yeah, that's me, all right. And it's Monday. My show is Monday and Tuesday. Monday, 6 to 8. Tuesday, 8 to 9.
Okay. And, I mean, that's... you've been covering a lot of medical topics.
Yeah.
Have you been covering them in their economic aspects? You probably have, because you're using alternative solutions that presumably are cheaper and more easily accessible to low-income folks.
Well, yeah, I like to go natural if possible, but some of them are actually just new ways of treating diabetes and some other diseases, somewhat new way of curing it, coming out of the medical profession. But mostly, a lot of the information I give out is actually coming out of medical doctors' offices, strangely.
In other words, my question for you is whether that it's more helpful for people who haven't got money, or whether it's more helpful to the upper middle class individual who is lolling about by their computer or radio at home and doesn't, you know, has, should we say, more access to insurance and so forth.
I would say it's more helpful to the smart people, to the natural people out there who don't want to go through the side effects of drugs and the ill effects in the body.
In other words, you're not commenting on the economics stuff that I'm pointing out. In other words, I'm talking about poorer people,
I would say yes. I would say it's obviously cheaper to, know, and better to use natural products. I mean, after all, I'm an MD, and I'm also a naturopath. I went back to school to study natural medicine, so I do believe natural is better.
Huh. We also have in the studio the inimitable catcher, if you can, Katie, or Kathleen, or is it Catherine? I'm never sure which it is. It's something that starts with K, right, K?
Yeah, it's Kathleen with L-E-A-N.
Oh, Kathleen. All right, I'll at some point try to make a note of that so as not to, well, I'll probably embarrass myself again anyway, Kate. So you two were scampering around the homeless meal, helping at the table, and so were you, Mike. Thank you very much for coming down. And we were giving out flyers at the homeless table, and also our main project, which we are still trying to put into shape, is to get people with citations who have gotten them in the last 5 months, 6 months actually, if you want to be technical, but we give it a month leeway, to show up at the homeless table or at the homeless meal where we happen to be, or accost one of us on the street and present us with a ticket and sign a claim against the city for the damages that they have suffered from that ticket. And thinking most specifically now both of sleeping tickets and, of course, tickets that are also accompanied by property loss, such as seizure of property, homeless gear, sleeping gear, or you come back to your camp and you find, you rarely find a ticket posted, you just find your stuff gone and your tent slashed, or at least have on a number of occasions, according to the reports I've gotten, and that probably folks listening in have heard, at least that's what the claims are, of people who I've interviewed on the streets. And the idea being that once you made a claim against the city, within 45 days they have to accept it or deny it, and they almost invariably deny it. They want to provide more work for their erstwhile city attorney, John Barisoni, or perhaps he wants to provide more work, or perhaps they just don't want to get the reputation of being an easy city that, you know, gives, actually pays for the damage it creates. You don't want to do that, at least not this government. And so what you then do is you then can either sue the city in municipal or superior court. It's both the same thing these days, which is costly and usually involves an attorney. Or you can take the matter to small claims court, where you can claim damages of up to $10,000. And that, of course, is what we're looking at. You can then subpoena people. You can you can subpoena documents. You can require the offending officers or rangers or, who knows, merchants or Take Back Santa Cruz vigilantes, whoever they may be, to come into court to defend themselves without attorneys. There's no attorneys, supposedly, and I think that's still the case, allowed in small claims court. So it's a nice theory. We don't know where it's going to go. We're just beginning to kind of raise this issue in the homeless community, and I will be, well, I or someone from Huff, I'm hoping, will be at the set up a table or use the table of the Food Not Bombs crew, which shows up every Saturday at 4 o'clock at the post office and has a meal. And they're also there on Sunday with something less of a meal, more of a food distribution, as I understand it. But Saturday at 4, hopefully we'll have some volunteers down there. You never can tell. And we'll see what we can do. I'm getting some advice from out-of-town attorney Paul Cook, who has successfully defended off attacks from the mayor of Baldwin Park, a suburb of Los Angeles, where Cook has become notorious for standing up for the rights of his boxing students. He's a teacher of boxing down there, and he's also an attorney, and he's also a young firebrand. He spoke before the homeless folks and also before the Penn University when he came through town. And he's very concerned about showing people how to use tools to resist the kind of abuse that is daily here in Santa Cruz for poor people, and probably in other cities as well. But we are here in Santa Cruz, so Santa Cruz is our focus. So that's what we were trying to do. A lot of people came to the table. We got a number of people who signed up as volunteers, or a number of people showed us their citations. We haven't signed anybody on to claim forms yet. We gave out one to a person who wanted to look it over and then give it back to us when he sees us again. That's always problematic. I like to sign up people while they're there, or else think, you know, let's move on. But we'll see if that happens. And again, this is a slow process. There's also, as I understand it, according to a report a couple weeks old from an activist and attorney, I guess we call him an attorney, Steve Plaich, who also community activist, really, more than an attorney, but says he's been to law school, and I haven't found any evidence to contradict that, nor, of course, have I looked at all the evidence of other people's credentials all the time. But he and Sarah Leonard and out-of-town attorney Judy Berry are supposedly putting together a class-action lawsuit against people, against the city, on behalf of people who have lost their property through the abuses, seizures, and destructive behavior of Parks and Rec rangers, labor-ready crews that follow in their wake, and such like. And I haven't got an update from him, and he just... It's a hard man to call. He calls back on the phone, but he does write an occasionally good article, and he has one in the current Street Spirit. That's Steve Plaich. Rhymes with H, for those who want to check him out. So I'm going to begin now with some older interviews, which I took on the street some weeks back. This is the middle of an interview with a guy who was he was busking. I think he was a musician. No, he was a poet. He was a street poet, and he was offering poetry for cash. And he was a little sensitive about reading his poetry because he wanted to make sure that his copyright protections were protected. And I said, on free radio, you've got to be joking. You know, everything we put on here is public domain. It simply is. But he did want to give his views about the laws, which are not my views. They're a contrast, and you can judge for yourself what you might want to do. We're talking about, of course, there are new laws that are and it will be going into effect in about 3 weeks that will implement the performance pens or performance cages or dots for dodos, as I sometimes call them, that you'll find on the sidewalk that will now limit the places that you can be legally if you want to set up a table, sit down with a cap in your hand, with a sign quietly looking for money, play a guitar with an open guitar case, vend, any of those things, will be limited to these dotted areas up and down Pacific Avenue, which are larger than the spaces that are legally allowed people now, although the spaces that our people are legally allowed are widely ignored, both by both police and performers. And they're also, there are 61 of them, but I would say at least half of those spaces are in areas that people are not likely to use because they're way off to the side. There are a couple new ones that have been added at intersections, and that's good. There have been none of them, as far as I know, are next to buildings, as promised by Vice Mayor and soon-to-be Mayor Don Lane. But, you know, I've asked Don specifically again and again for the information as to where his magical and mythical spaces are that are actually next to buildings. Why is it important to be next to a building? Well, if you're a performer, it is much better to have your back to a building than sing out into the street. We're talking about a building that is, you know, like a wall of some kind, not a building that blocks any kind of traffic or, you know, interferes with what a merchant is doing. And it also is healthier. You don't have to, you know, breathe in exhaust fumes from cars and motorcycles and also risk getting hit by a door that's opening from a car or a person who's crossing the street. And the noise that comes also from motorcycles and so forth is, you know, it can be on occasion rather overpowering. And it's probably overpowering even if you're playing against a building. But also, there are all kinds of good reasons that have been presented, incredibly presented, by Tom Noddy, who was himself the originator with a couple of others of the Street Performers Voluntary Guidelines of 1980, abandoned in 2002, or actually 2003, by the City Council in an attempt to give the police more tools to drive away those that they felt were inappropriate to the downtown ambiance, which they use with great regularity, mostly by not so much by enforcing laws, but by giving orders. They're big at giving orders all over the place. And if people don't obey the orders, of course, they don't know what's going to happen, so they're usually it's yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full. And when it isn't, you suddenly get a cluster of cops appearing like cockroaches when you turn on the lights. Suddenly they're there. I saw that this morning when I went to the Cafe Pergolesi, sort of in preparation for this. And indeed, Kate, what did you see? You actually came late, I guess. You saw this.
I was there before you, actually, looking for you for you.
But you weren't at the actual event across the street in the Elm Street parking lot.
Well, I came outside and saw your car, and then, of course, I saw where you were, and I saw you engaged with the police.
Yeah, I'm talking about the incident, though.
Right. The incident, I didn't see the incident.
Right, let me give the description of the beginning.
Tell you what I heard.
Yeah, no, I want to hear that. But there were three individuals sitting inside the on the berm of a tree area in the middle of the Elm Street parking lot, which is across from the Elm Street Mission and from the Cafe Pergolesi, between Pacific and Cedar, for those of you who know the downtown. And there were two squad cars pulled up blocking the area this is a parking lot, a city parking lot. And one of them was a station wagon driven by our very own sergeant at arms at City Council, John Bush, who's a sergeant on the streets as well as being a sergeant at arms, who has taken away my tape recorder on numerous occasions in order to implement the mayor's "thou shalt not record unless you are standing or sitting next to your tape recorder or your audio recorder." I'm still an old school guy who's being forced to do new school because of my dying equipment, to the amusement and perhaps edification of Dr. Mike, who's been trying to school me in how to use new equipment and it actually may be helpful in doing this today. Digital equipment, as he's saying. Anyway, but getting back to this event in the Elm Street parking lot, I was supposed to be making signs for this event today where we were going to advise people come on over, show us your tickets, we'll help you fill out a claim form. And instead, I noticed these three people, two men and one woman, looked like counterculture traveler-type kids. They weren't kids. They were adults, I think. And they were, although I don't know their age, I didn't check their IDs, they were being grilled by Officer Winston and a female officer who I didn't recognize, younger woman who was blonde, and also a Sergeant Bush. Sergeant Bush was also rummaging through their vehicle, although they said they had not given him permission to search their vehicle. And
out-of-state plates.
And the plates were from Tennessee, actually, to be very specific, as far as I remember. And I immediately started broadcasting from my kind of booming voice at the edge of the parking lot, because if you walk into a parking lot in Santa Cruz, unless you're walking through, which I should have done immediately anyway, but didn't initially do because of my internal cop who always says, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, this is legal, this is illegal, instead of saying, what's the right thing to do here? I mean, let's just do the right thing, and, you know, that's the should be the priority. And the right thing would be to get close and to interview or to observe and document what's going on. I did finally walk into the area after giving some commentary and loudly drawing people's attention, and a couple of African-American locals pulled out their video phones and began viewing this incident. Nobody got beaten up. We're not talking about fire hoses or tear gas, you know, or six bullets in the gut a la Ferguson, nothing like that. What we're talking about, though, is harassment. And, you know, police officers giving these stern lectures and searching illegally, in my view, or certainly unconstitutionally, Supreme Court's heightened powers to police be damned. The Fourth Amendment says, you know, you should be secure in your person and effects unless there's a warrant or probable cause, and we don't have any of that, really, except the basic law, and this is the law that Sergeant Bush wouldn't tell me until I finally kind of squeezed out of him what was going on later. By getting the, they'll always say, oh, this is a matter of privacy. We don't want to, you know, disturb the privacy of the people by telling the community what is happening. And I shouted to the police, to the people who were being held by the police, do you mind if, what are you being held for? And usually they'll say, we don't know. And then you say, is it okay if the officer tells me? And then they usually say, yes, and then you ask again, and then the officer gives some other excuse. I'm very busy, I've got to go, you black off 3 feet, you're too close, whatever. But in this case, Sergeant Bush did point out that they were violating the, what I call the parking lot panic law, which is the law that says you can't be in a parking lot unless you're parking or retrieving your vehicle, and then only for 15 minutes, and also if you're walking through, that's also allowed. But when I talked to one of the people afterward, as you may hear from some of this audio, if we can ever get this thing working, and Dr. Mike is hard at work at that, or presumably may be able to work on that, they told me, no, we just arrived, and we were sitting in the car for no more than 5 minutes, and we were rolling cigarettes. Bush claimed they were smoking the cigarettes, and he then used their alleged crime by being in the parking lot. Although I would say if they were accurate, we would have to ask him how he knew they were there for more than 15 minutes with their vehicle. He could claim, oh, well, they may have been there for only 5 minutes, but they weren't parking or retrieving. They were just sitting in their vehicle. And in any case, this is all pretty arcane and obscure. The point was they were harassing three people on Thanksgiving. And my point was to make them feel as uncomfortable as possible and to clarify for the community, without interfering with what they're doing, you know. I wasn't interested in interfering with what they were doing. And Katie will have her thoughts on this, too, in a moment. Well, actually, I would have loved to interfere with what they were doing, because I think it's complete crap, and they're best be advised to go after real crime. But interfering with an officer is a misdemeanor. You know, that's the nice charge they use, and they can't think of anything else. So instead, I was advising the community loudly what they were doing. And I did ask a couple questions of the officers. And these three were sort of meekly sitting down. They were no threat to anyone. And eventually, they were released without citations. And they were warned not to take heroin. And they were warned it was dangerous to... There were certain drugs that were dangerous. I couldn't hear everything that was being said. And there was apparently marijuana in the car, and they had found a small quantity of marijuana, and they acted like they were the most charitable police in the world by not ticketing them for marijuana. I don't think that was an example of charity. I think that was an example of you're being watched by people with cameras all over the place. Don't make a bust of three people on Thanksgiving Day with two squad cars and three cops for a small quantity of marijuana when you had no probable cause to search them in the first place. You're not going to get anywhere with the prosecution. But, you know, I wasn't there for the entire incident. I came as the incident was in progress. Afterward, however, Katie showed up, and she insisted on walking to the middle of the parking lot and defiantly sitting down, perhaps daring the police to come and hassle her. They, of course, ignored her and moved on. But, Katie, what were your thoughts on that?
I have a couple thoughts on this. One is while I was at the cafe waiting for you, I went outside a couple times, and there was this public works truck, the Santa Cruz public works truck, kept driving around. I mean, he drove a few times. I wonder if that person reported to the police these out-of-state cars that obviously these kids, the cars were a mess. They're, you know, their suitcases, all their stuff was everywhere, everything but a surfboard and a K-Pig sticker. And so I observed that, and I was curious about that. And then when I was sitting there trying to see if the police would come and say, put your cigarette out, what are you doing? I was timing, you know, I was there for 8 minutes. Friends of these kids came by and asked, you know, do you know where our friends went? And, you know, we saw the police here. Did they take them? And I said, well, no, they went into the restaurant. Do I look like a hooker? And they started laughing. I thought, well, maybe they'll come and cite me for, you know, soliciting my body.
You'll be cited for being in a parking lot without permission of the city. Actually, there's at least two exceptions to the parking lot panic law. One is if you are a city employee, of course, because then you could be in the parking lot all day and all night if you'd like.
Can you smoke? Roll cigarettes?
I don't think you can smoke if you're, at least, although I don't know if the police would stop you from smoking if you're a city employee. I know there's been a lot of claims and accounts and some visual documentation of selective enforcement of people smoking. That's an issue I brought up at the Tuesday night Ferguson support for Michael Brown, a denunciation of the release of Darren Wilson. He was actually never even held in custody, Officer Darren Wilson, if you want to use that kind of title. In Ferguson, Missouri, after he shot Michael Brown dead, and the district attorney, all of whose relatives are police officers, according to a recent report I read, and he himself lost his father in an incident, completely in the view of numerous columnists and claims on the local community as conveyed by the media, very biased guy, and a white guy, you know, as well. I'm not saying that necessarily indicates bias, but the entire power structure in Ferguson is white. The police department is white. The city council is, I think, with one exception, white. Anyway, there was a protest in Santa Cruz in support of the protests that were happening across the country around Ferguson. In fact, there may still be protests going on tonight. I'm going to check to see if that's actually happening, even on this holiest of all turkey nights. Native American Slaughter Day.
While you're doing that, Robert, when I first pulled up by the cafe at 11 o'clock-ish, there was a black security guard, First Alarm, walking down the street. You know, there just seems to be so many eyes on us wherever you turn. It's like, wow, there's... did you see him also? Dr. Mike saw him, too.
I didn't notice. My eyes were focused on these three cops. And as I said, eventually I got bolder, and I moved closer to them and asked more questions. I was told to leave the parking lot. You cannot be here. I said, I'm allowed to walk through the parking lot, Officer Winston. You know that. Let's not be a mean police officer, because it's true. You are. And, well, here's a crime scene. This is all a crime scene. He said, I see. Uh-huh. And, of course, that's nice terminology, both for throwing a nice black shadow over everything that's happening around you, increasing and justifying your authority, and, of course, eliminating reporters from the area, because that's what I am in this regard. I'm a critic as well, of course, but I'm also a reporter. Looking at the situation in terms of Ferguson, it looks like the stories tonight are that the protests are dwindling, which is, to me, is unfortunate, because I think these are issues that are appropriately raised and need to be raised persistently and continuously. And that was one of the problems I had with our protest, which was a nice protest. There was, you know, more than 100 people, maybe more than 150 people at the town clock on Tuesday night at immediately following 5:30 when the protest was called for. But the numbers, that wasn't just that they dwindled, it's that I'm not aware that there was any follow-up intended. There aren't follow-up protests or actions specifically proposed. And this has, of course, always been my issue about racial profiling in Santa Cruz. You know, they don't want to talk about that, or they only want to talk about it in the abstract, or they want to talk about it so they can talk it to death and nonviolent everybody out off to the side, by the which I mean not that people should necessarily be violent about anything, but to feel violent emotions about this can be an important motivating force, and in fact that's the reason the protests, I think, erupted, were because of those feelings at the blatant injustices that was revealed so repeatedly, both first by the shooting and then more recently by the grand jury decision not to indict Winston of any crimes whatsoever. So, just for those who don't know, we walked all around. There were a number of speakers. I was allowed to speak after initially being denied that opportunity by Simba Kenyatta, who was running the thing, because he didn't like my criticism of the organization, which he is now a member, apparently the head of the NAACP locally. He'd previously been head, or at least on the board of directors of SCORE, Santa Cruz Coalition to Combat Racism in Santa Cruz County. I've got that a little wrong, but that's more or less what it is. And I've been a constant critic of both these groups in terms of they're not taking up any individual cases publicly that have come up down the pike. We've seen them, you know, on Indy Bay. Yemenides Brown, whose name I'm mangling, was her brother and her cousin were hauled off to jail after Officer Barnett accused them of smoking in a parking lot, which again was the thing that Bush and his and Winston used today against these youths who were at the Elm Street parking lot, and they were taken down somewhat forcefully, and some would even say brutally. And I guess they're still going to court. The charges are resisting an officer, things of that sort, although they maybe have one. I don't know what the expanded charges are. But there's been a hush-hush around this because the people at the Red Church, which is a block away from this incident when it happened, didn't want to embarrass the church, the congregation. And I think, to be fully fair, they were afraid that the person who is in the church program, Miss Brown is in the church program, they didn't want her targeted by police further. So the best thing to do is to ignore the situation, which, of course, is what America generally does and what people are suggest that they should do when police officers are abusive because, first of all, you'll never get anywhere if you file a complaint. This is generally true. But nonetheless, if you let people know what's going on, as happened on Tuesday night at this massive protest, then you might begin to get somewhere. Kate?
You know, the protest was wonderful and marching to the police department and all that stuff was great. But relative to the speakers, I was disappointed by the NAACP. They didn't say we have any follow-up. They didn't say, you know, look online. They read a letter and, you know, they said these various things that to me at that moment were not relevant. I was extremely disappointed by a black man who has a community face from community television, and he stood up and said, I fear for myself, my children, and my grandchildren. And I thought, you know what? Why haven't you been doing this on community TV? Educate us on what's happening here in the black community. And then the Center for Nonviolence. I was a huge fan of Scott Kennedy. I loved this man. And they said, come to the Center for Nonviolence after the march and we'll make some plans. I haven't read any plans on where we're going to gather again, where we're going to protest again, and where we're going to continue talking about the vigilantes and police brutality and police accountability. So the whole thing didn't end with any actions. Zero. And this is Santa Cruz County. No actions are going to be taken against police accountability in our own community. Dump. It's done. Oh, well. I'm sorry. Those speakers were disappointing to me.
Yeah, there was a big protest Tuesday night. I would have covered it more, but the last of my failing tape recorders went dead, and I don't have any audio of it there. I believe there is some stuff online. If you go to indiebay.org Santa Cruz, which I'm doing right now, you can find Ferguson the Day After in Santa Cruz, and there's some stuff. Here's a little audio of this right now. And this is about the Santa Cruz protest on Tuesday night. And folks are marching with a Black Lives Matter sign going through the streets, although some people wanted to divert us onto the sidewalks. We stayed in the streets. And there you are, Katie, at the head of the protest. A lot of signs. We want justice. A lot of white folks, an occasional black face or two, walking up Pacific Avenue. No justice, K-N-O-W, no justice, no peace. Hands up, don't shoot.
No more pigs in our community!
Don't shoot!
No more pigs in our community!
Don't shoot!
No more pigs in our community, of course, is what he's saying.
No more pigs in our community!
And they're not talking about Ferguson. They're talking about Santa Cruz. And now they're approaching the police station, because even though the march was originally supposed to be very tame and walk to the Resource Center for Nonviolence on Ocean, under the leadership of Keith McHenry, who's walking in front of the protest now as they approach the police station. They did go to the police station, and there's a catch if you can. Katie, giving the finger to the police department. This is pretty pretty nasty there, Katie. You're not going to make it to a sergeant. Yes, but it's rude. You're very rude, I'm afraid. I can't accept that. You're just. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. But, and I'm also.
Siding with the police.
And I was walking around in a bathrobe, as I often do, indicating solidarity with and satire. Solidarity with homeless people sleeping, and satire against the expenditure of resources for sleeping outside, criminalizing sleeping outside. And there's a lot of, the video shows everyone in front of the Santa Cruz Police Department at night. There were no cops throughout the entire rally that were visible, or security guards. I think they were probably specifically directed to stay away, is my guess. And again, there was no decision in this group either. Even this is a sort of a limited group, probably of about 75 people who made it to the police station, to do anything the next day, the next night, and thereafter. Although, and they then marched across town, across the river, to Ocean Street and down to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, where a handful of us sat around in a circle, giving our names and saying, gosh, what can we do about all this? But nothing specific was proposed. After about 20 minutes, I got tired of listening to what appeared to be a Resource Center for Nonviolence recruiting session, in part, and also in part an attempt to calm down or cool off the community, and I left. But people did take the streets, and but it was a way of stopping the, it was letting people vent so they wouldn't do anything more. I think there was legitimate concern. I'm concerned that this is, you know, something that happens. People get all excited and then they just go home.
Well, I was encouraged by the number of young people there who I felt wanted direction. If we had said, we're meeting tomorrow at 5, I bet you half of them would have showed up. But we just didn't have any direction for them as adults.
Katie, you didn't announce a meeting the next day at 5. I'm kind of, nor did I, for that matter.
I was trying to find Keith. Keith, what are we going to do with all
Keith
these
McHenry
people?
Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs was, I think, instrumental in making sure, although I don't know that he actually was.
He was the march. He made the march happen.
I think he actually moved the march toward the police station rather than toward Resource Center. And there were two cops who eventually came out of the police station and observed, again, the inevitable Sergeant Bush. And I think it's either Officer Eboleth or Sergeant Eboleth. I'm not sure if he's moved ahead to that. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Katie and Dr. Mike and Robert.
Happy Kill a Turkey Clog Your Arteries Day.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I've had my little share of the dead beasts.
Hey, I want to hear more about gathering a bunch of people and getting real angry and then everybody going home.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that seems to be what seems to happen. You sort of, everybody shoots their wad and then goes back to Black Friday shopping on Friday
Or whatever.
Saturday or Sunday. And my real critique with a lot of the organizations in Santa Cruz is they are very institutional, and they, if they don't start off that way, they become that way, and then they suck up to, or have to suck up, or feel like they have to suck up to the powers that be to get their grant money and run their programs and all that sort of stuff. So that's the frustrating part that I see with a lot of these institutional groups. You know, NAACP, the whatever that is, SCORE. It seems like SCORE, all they do is stand at the town clock. I don't know that they've really done anything else. And it would be nice if they did something else, like work with HUF on some of the things that you guys have uncovered. But I think sometimes what happens, just from an outsider's perspective, is people get their egos attached, and it becomes more about them rather than any big issue or actually resolving anything.
I kind of agree with you, caller, in a certain way. You don't even have to work with HUF. I mean, HUF is a... We're a small group of, struggling types. And, it's not a matter of joining HUF or working with HUF. But if the information comes out that there is racial profiling happening downtown in terms of petty things like smoking tickets and police stops and so forth, and humiliating kinds of things that serve to make people feel uncomfortable, and I think that many African Americans will tell you is the norm here in Santa Cruz, as elsewhere, then this needs to be addressed, as I think you're pointing out, by groups like, well, it doesn't need to be addressed by NAACP and SCORE, because they don't want to address it. They won't address it. But it needs to be addressed by some groups. And you would think that those groups, because they claim to be interested in the rights of the oppressed people who they're talking about and who constitute their board often, in large part, that they'd act on it, but they don't. And so the question is, what do you do next? I mean, I went to an ACLU meeting on Monday, for example, and the ACLU, when I was there, I didn't go to the whole thing, had said nothing about Ferguson that I know of. They made no comments about racial profiling here in Santa Cruz whatsoever. Although Simba Kenyatta, the new chair of the NAACP, and as I was saying, the master of ceremonies, and the holder of the microphone at this Tuesday rally the next day, protesting the Ferguson verdict or decision to free Wilson, he gave us an impassioned speech about the need for district elections, a new Citizens Police Review Board, and an end to private financing of elections and public financing of elections, all of which are okay ideas, although they don't have much to do with naming immediate names and pursuing cases here in Santa Cruz that have already been revealed and exposed. And, often, of course, attorneys will tell you, well, this person has a record. Of course, how many African Americans don't, given the, focus on African Americans in the drug war and the criminalization through mass incarceration, to steal a phrase from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Anyway, yeah, I'll be playing some more of it. Did you get to the rally yourself, caller?
I did not. I was actually up in a Northern California town where things were pretty active. Here's one just thing that I hear a lot of in Santa Cruz, which I find infuriating. A lot of times people say, well, we have to get our anger up in solidarity for Ferguson. And I agree, you know, Zimmerman case, Ferguson, let's shoot a black kid on a playground. So, you know, I mean, there are injustices happening all over the United States, and it's something very much to get pissed off about and get out and show your anger. But, well, lots of times people discount what's happening in the community, our own community, and they say stuff like, well, oh, well, that the real stuff's happening someplace else. And it's like, that's bullshit, because it's happening in our own community. It's a different flavor, you know, because we don't have actually a very large population of, we're not very diverse in Santa Cruz. And yet when there is diversity, and the reason why I mentioned Huff is because you guys actually took initiative to go and look at the citations and actually pull out the evidence of what seems to be profiling. And so it is, there is a sense of Ferguson in Santa Cruz, which is when you say, well, how come if this is a certain percentage of the population, this particular officer seems to only find, you know, this certain percentage of African Americans that are smoking. I mean, it's like, can we question that? And why aren't you pissed off when this evidence is brought up? Does it have to be just other places? Can you get pissed off about things that are going on in your own community? And that's one of my frustrations about activism in Santa Cruz, which is there's a tendency for a number of people to want to, I don't know how to put this, but sort of peace center nonviolence everything. You want to, like, they want to tap everything down and go, oh, now, we have to just overly process this, and we can't get angry, or don't get too angry, or, you know, there's an institutional way to address this. And I don't know that that's necessarily always the case.
Well, I think, caller, it's because it's risky to raise issues in your own community.
Exactly.
And also because if you are a leader in this community and you are closely enmeshed with other, you know, boards, and such as, for example, Steve Plaich is, he's just one example of this. They're all, I mean, it's just typical. That's one of the problems that was brought up at the Huff meeting today. I actually kicked down $5, I'm ashamed to admit, to the ACLU on Monday so that I could stay in the room and would not get kicked out by Chair Peter Gelblum, who then attempted to kick me out by saying, well, we don't allow members to stay in the room, only board members. I probably should have then asked, okay, I'd like to get on the board. Will you please vote me? And somebody suggested that I join the board of the ACLU. That was, you know, I could make some wonderful changes that Steve Plaich had been urging, that, and he does have some allies who've joined the board in the last 3 years. Jay and Mithril of Occupy, and Dan Etler as well. And, you know, the idea that we can all bore from within, or get bored from within, actually, is what happened to me. Get very bored. But, you know, the answer is you don't change these institutions. They change you. Even if you are, you know, fiery and militant, they'll take up your time.
Yeah, they will. I mean,
go ahead.
I was going to say this. I think for people who don't have energy, it's important to have those people in these institutions. I mean, if they're, for instance, if you had people who didn't have energy but had a spine, it would be good to have people in certain positions in certain places, you know, like these boards that are, you know, voting on RV crap, and the people who, the Rachel Naroyans who graduate from these boards and go up to become councilmembers. If you don't have really a spine, but you have the internal fortitude to sit around and listen to bullshit all the time, but can speak up, great. I think these people would be good in these various boards. On the other hand, I hate to see people who have energy and who are willing to, so to speak, not literally, but light a fire by, you know, finding the investigations and bringing things to the forefront, and activism, journalism, activism, then I think it's important for all of us to work together, because I don't think any one part is going to win. You know, I mean, people who, you can see that Michael Posner doesn't, and Don Lame doesn't do certain things.
These are two council members. In fact, Lane is going to be mayor in probably about 3 weeks.
A wider movement.
Yes. Sorry. So Well, the question then is where to go from here. That's really the issue. And, of course,
I think that's a good question.
Yep.
We that's what we as a group and people have been asking in New York Occupy. People are asking in Oakland. I mean, different communities have different solutions, but I think it's essential that we have to start asking, like, what do we have to do to stop the war on poverty, the criminalization of poverty, at the very least, in Santa Cruz? I mean, because that's obviously what's at the forefront.
Well, the one thing to do, I think, I mean, I don't know what to do, but you can obviously go after specific targets by raising people's awareness of them if people are angry enough and want to risk enough. But, for instance, I mean, I was hoping there would be a meeting of the Occupy movement, that is to say the Occupy UCSC, or Occupy UC movement,
uh-huh.
That was, you know, I visited up in Berkeley last weekend, that, you know, was going strong until yesterday, or was going anyway, at the UCSC, but now apparently has ended. The building has been, you know, they abandoned it under, it looks like it's not clear why they abandoned it, but I think it was under threats from the police after a week.
Yeah.
It could be Thanksgiving, but
yeah.
They removed protest signs, cleared walls. Participants said they planned to meet over the weekend to discuss further options. Well, they're meeting to discuss. But again, they're not presenting another target saying, we will reassemble at the following point.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And on Tuesday, according to this very brief story from KSBW, which is a bad source to go to anyway, two campus police officers visited the building and advised demonstrators that they were occupying it illegally. And I wonder if that might have been one of the reasons that they left.
Could be, because no one wants any, they don't want a record.
Yeah, that's always a fear. I mean, and also, as we know, although people were willing to take to the streets at least briefly in this protest on Tuesday, there were a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, however, this protest is backed by national fervor. And I think that's important. People feel supported by the fact that it's not just happening in Santa Cruz, it's happening elsewhere. Although we have to focus on Santa Cruz because that's our place here.
Right.
And no one else is going to be doing it unless we do it. And other people will start to do it, both in their own towns and giving us support from afar, I think, if we do this.
I agree. I think that there's what's going on in Santa Cruz. I know that I mentioned Huff, but it's big. You know, even if everything goes down in flames, I think it's important that the word of what's going on in Santa Cruz is sort of waged in a larger format rather than just Santa Cruz Indie Bay. I mean, in terms of really putting it out there, like, hey, you know, this is what's going on in this supposedly progressive town. You know, they are absolutely trying to criminalize people simply for the fact of poverty. They don't have a roof. People don't have a roof over your head. You have, in essence, less rights than you do as a person who is housed.
It's a matter also, caller, of the foreclosures. I mean, I meet people almost every day who are living on the streets now because they lost their homes that they bought, you know, in 2001 or 2002 as first-time buyers. And then in 2006, 2007, they're homeless. And it's really pathetic. But relative to rallying forward, I mean, Huff and Indy are pretty much, you know, we're taking this on. There's also a movement, Santa Cruz, what is it called, CPV.org, that I highly recommend you look into that. But I feel that the NAACP should be calling Robert, calling the ACLU, calling the Nonviolent Center, and saying, thank you for attending this protest. This is our next meeting. We're going to take on this police review board issue.
Well, the NAACP traditionally has never been a progressive movement. It's never been a progressive movement. I mean, when civil rights were being waged in the streets in the 60s, you know, even into the 70s, the NAACP was, you know, that was the institutional movement who was embarrassed by, you know, Malcolm X and you know, so they ran the other direction. So they've never been they're not progressive. They are the National Association. You know, I mean, they're institutional, and so I don't know that people even locally have the chops to really do that much in terms of progressive organizing. I think it's going to be incumbent upon people who are activists to make inroads, like with tenants, with the burgeoning tenants organization in Santa Cruz.
Is there a burgeoning tenants organization in Santa Cruz?
There was a forum where people started to get together, and there's people that are talking about investigating, ownership and tenants issues in terms of trying to get the dialogue going to see if we can get anything happening in Santa Cruz around tenants' rights.
Well, I know there was one city council candidate meeting that Cynthia Berger, good for her, put together, and I know that there's been some assistance kind of provided individually to a few tenants, and I know that I'm just wondering, have you heard anything more about a tenants' movement? I'd love to hear more if there is actually.
I've read some posts by the person who actually sponsored that forum. And they seem to be, that person seems to be moving forward in terms of trying to organize people in beach flats around listening first about what do they feel they would like to do or have done. So I think in terms of what's going on right now, my perception is outreach, which is actually an important thing because it's actually going into communities and saying, what do you want? Rather than sort of the top-down approach of like a lot of Santa Cruz progressive, which is typically a bunch of white people telling brown people, this is what we need to do.
You mean like we're doing right now?
Well, I don't know that you're telling people what to do, and I'm not white, actually. So.
Katie is. She's telling the NAACP what to do, and they're mostly black people.
I'm fine with the NAACP doing what they're doing if that's what they choose to do. I'm just saying I don't expect them to do much because they never really have done much.
Oh, yeah. I mean, originally, of course, the NAACP was started by people like Du Bois, who actually
yeah.
it was radical, but he actually started it in opposition to the Carver, Booker T. Washington.
Even within various organizations,
Uncle Tom movement.
My only point is in Santa Cruz, I don't see any. I haven't seen anything certainly from SCORE other than people standing at the town clock. And I'm not, if you want to stand at the town clock, that's great, but I don't really know what that does.
Well, I got to say that SCORE has been getting lots of grants, and they talk about retraining the police. That's the big deal with SCORE.
Yeah.
It's frankly, and I if that's what they got together and said they were going to do from the beginning, that would be one thing. But they held community-wide meetings 5 or 6 years ago, maybe even longer, with Simba Kenyatta in the middle of it, saying that they were going to, they wanted people's accounts of racial abuse and racial profiling by police departments, and they got them, a lot of accounts. And I repeatedly asked them, show us what happened to these goddamn reports.
Right.
And they just disappeared into the files.
Right.
They're gone. And, new reports, they don't respond to either.
Right.
Although, SCORE member Dennis Etler did express some outrage at what happened to Ms. Brown and her cousin and her brother in the parking lot next to parking lot next to Pacific Avenue.
Right.
When they were, dragged off to jail, two of them, for essentially a Barnett-initiated smoking incident, as I understand it.
Right.
Anyway, so let me move on here, unless there's something more you want to...
No, that's it. I'm glad to hear that things are going on Thanksgiving. Glad to hear people showed up. Lots of stuff was going on up in Oakland.
Do you want to report on that? Do you have any reports on Oakland?
Not that I really want to share.
Some shady business in Oakland.
No, it's just, everybody's, you can watch what was streamed. I mean, everybody has a different perspective of, what was going on depending on where you were and et cetera.
But I'm glad
to see people are pissed. I just, like you said, I'd like to see some follow-through where people go, okay, we're pissed. What do we need to do?
Maybe you should first talk to Chris Hedges, and he'll tell you what to do.
There you go.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Take care. And, though I, slightly dissing Chris Hedges here, he's got a lot of... he's standing up for lawsuits against the NDAA, and he's got a lot of positive stuff. And he's very eloquent about the impact of war and the kind of addiction that war can create. So,
but also Chris works
however,
in prisons.
He also savagely attacked and misrepresented, I think, black bloc tactics. So I don't like that aspect of his presentation. But that's another story. And we don't even have, you know, these actions happening now, although perhaps we do. Perhaps the caller is engaged in these. We don't know what's going on. And who knows? Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm in the studio with Katie and Mike, and you, too, if you want to boom your voice in. We'll all kind of babble together. Let's hear some more from... I'm not quite sure when this is, but these are reports from the street. Fair enough?
Yes.
Okay.
I also talked to the information booth, and I feel that if the busking, of course, your listeners probably know what busking is. If the busking laws are, if they're clear and they're flexible and they're fair, then it's good for all the artists in the community. And even the artists who, I don't do it right now, but there are artists who tour the country, and this is one of their stops. And I think that that it can't really be a true artist community if the busking laws are too restrictive. And yeah, right here, I believe it's at a good point, and I'm hopeful for the future of Santa Cruz and the artists here.
Well, I'm glad he's hopeful. I'm not. But that's okay. That's his voice, and that's what he thinks. This is the poet, I would call it poet for pennies, but he was a poet on the street who didn't want to offer poetry without yet getting some reassurance about, you know, that he would get some kind of, I don't know, royalty back or protection so his stuff couldn't be sold commercially. I'm not sure what the story is. In any case... yeah, the busking laws, we'll see. My advice to people is I encourage you to protest the busking laws. But the problem with that, of course, is that the fines are severe. They're $300 or so dollars that they can start throwing at you. And for people who are buskers, you can't so easily throw away busking tickets as, for example, penniless homeless people throw away the sleeping tickets, as I'm, you know, you find that it frequently happens. Because... you're out there on the streets to try to make enough money to move along if you're a busker. And if you then have to be saddled with a second ticket, can be a misdemeanor, up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. On the other hand, if people are doing all this together in a group and it's a protest, that and if that has any, you know, if that can spark widespread resistance, which is always problematic, that's another issue. It's always, you know... it's easy to say go out there and try, because unless you're doing it yourself, you're not you know, you're not taking the risk. Anyway, let's hear some more of our busker guy, who I don't entirely agree with. In fact, I rather strongly disagree with. But let's hear him.
Because the city council will be voting in 3 days on new laws.
Will they? I did not hear about that.
Oh, yeah. They will set up, I don't know.
What are the new laws?
Well, if you look on the sidewalk, you will see dots. It's kind of hard to see them at night.
Okay.
These are not the dots, but they're similar to them.
In some areas.
They're
okay.
Blue, they're red, and they're yellow. And
okay.
They essentially restrict performing to less than 2% of the sidewalk, which to me is abusive. And also,
that's in 3 days.
That will be in 3 days, a final reading of the ordinance.
Where can I find that news?
Well, it's online on Santa Cruz Indie Media, which is a website I write on, indiebay.org.
Is that on the card you gave me?
If you go...
I could write it down, but...
If you call me, I will give you information on that. It is...
Your name is?
It's on the card, Robert Norris.
Okay, Robert, and my name is Josh. I'll give you a call about that. I got to get back to performing.
Please do.
Thanks for the tip, because I hope that does not pass.
And good luck with the poetry. Remember, two roads diverge in a narrow wood, and we won't get into
that. In Santa Cruz, it's two roads diverge in a very strange wood.
Thank you very much, Josh.
You're welcome.
All right, man. And we have the Saturday Night Mariachi, mariachiing it up, but without three young children.
Y así despacito, que alarguemos.
down here across from the library. It's around 15 to 4. I'm talking to a very confidential source whose latest word is...
The SUPD won't let homeless people sleep underneath bridges during the rain.
And did they... This is an attempt to help the homeless get cheap showers. Is that the plan?
No, they don't want them under bridges because it's an eyesore.
You mean for those people who wander under bridges during the rain, it might hurt to make their eyes feel sore?
I guess so.
Well, the police are always looking after your optical well-being. You know that, right?
Yes.
Any other reports on any other exciting adventures in Santa Cruz that the homeless people could get into or getting into?
No.
And we've been talking with...
Nobody.
Nobody. Thank you, nobody. So it's the Santa Cruz City Council, November 18th, 2014. And the item on the agenda is the stay away order. And, Pegsky First Alarm guy, Tall John, is wandering the area, chatting with Parks and Rec Ranger woman. Perhaps she's the boss. Ranger, not sure. And here we are outside. Pat Colby's providing a meal, which is some kind of beans and rice, and there are some brownies. Keith McHenry is sitting in the chair that I intend to take inside City Council.
And this is the November 18th meeting of the Santa Cruz City Council, where a... first reading of the revised stay-away ordinance happened, and I'm not going to go into the lengthy description that I usually do about the stay-away ordinance, but we were there to protest it, and it was actually due to come back, we thought, on the 25th, but it didn't, and now we learned it's coming back almost certainly, and probably for a slam-dunk rubber stamping. It doesn't mean we won't be there trying to yowl our protest on December 9th. Which will be the last harumph of the last of this city council. And they will also be congratulating themselves, commending themselves, patting themselves on the back, and initiating the new city council, which will then go into force. That's going to be with Cynthia Chase and Rochelle Naroyan. And, of course, David Terrazas, reelected. And Don Lane, I'm told, is likely to be elected mayor because he got the most votes, an election or two back. So, this, however, is November 18th at the City Council, and we were hanging around outside. I'm not entirely sure if a lot of this is airworthy, but if it isn't, I'll try to cover it up fast and cut it off quickly. You, however, may be airworthy, 427-3772, call in number. Give it a try.
Boston, Texas, but he's been there consulting. You know what, did he have his own company?
I'm asking Sergeant Bush. Sergeant, you going to take my tape over today if I leave it up there? I have to go watch the agenda and do some reading. More than likely, yes. I appreciate your candor. Thank you.
And I think his answer was, I don't remember the exact words. You can replay this. I think it was, in essence, yes, probably. And, in fact, he did make motions to take my tape recorder. I intercepted him and engaged in a mock boxing match with him. Because I was sitting near the tape recorder in the front row, but that wasn't good enough for him. He wanted me to be sitting right next to the tape recorder, so I moved and again sat down in a chair I had placed facing the audience right next to the bar that separates the dais of the city council and their associated staff from the rest of us in the audience.
So it's about 9 to 4.
So this is our reality check. The gold line is our CDBG funding, and you can see that over the last 20 years, it's just steadily declined, about 40%. The green line is our home funding, and it started in 1996 directly to the city.
And what this is a discussion of CDBG and HUD funding for Santa Cruz projects that involve housing, which, you know, is relevant to homelessness. And there was a rather lengthy discussion of this, which I believe is available online. I think they actually got this up pretty promptly online. But it's not something that I am particularly conversant with. I know that some of the main people who were talking about this, the issues as to, you know, what kind of housing money is available were also raised 2 days later. I think it was Wednesday before last at the police station in the community room with, I think, a HUD presenter, but also a sort of a an apple polisher for the city council named, I think it was Susan O'Hara, who heads the, or is the paid staff person for the DUP projects, the Downtowners, well, it's the DAP project, Downtowners Attacking the Poor, as I like to call them, but they call themselves the Downtown Accountability Project. And the issue here is whether they're claiming to, you know, to be really offering services to people on the street, helping them get rid of their tickets, you know, getting them into housing as a way of addressing problems that both impact them and also the poor merchants who just can't stand seeing them there on the street day after day, mainly because they're afraid they impact their businesses. Or maybe there's a lot of ambulance activity and police activity around some of them that raises the costs to the city and county. I'm not sure about the city, but I think the county would have to pay for it. Maybe the city, too, fire department and so forth. So the idea is to, you know, put these people into cheaper and cheap housing somewhere, and you know, which isn't a bad idea. I mean, cheap housing as an option is a great idea. But really, unfortunately, what I think is happening here, and again, this is my opinion, and I do not have a lot of stats to back it up, because I haven't really been closely following it, although I tried to follow it more closely with some public records this summer. They are indeed offering people sort of a one chance in a housing program. But then if you fail, if you get another citation for, you know, being drunk downtown or, I don't know, sitting next to a building or bad-mouthing a cop or, you know, getting a stay-away order from a park. Again, I'm not sure. They haven't told us what their criteria are. They didn't tell us then as to who gets in the program. And nor do we have the criteria for what's going to kick you out of the program. Then you're offered either I'm told this, and I've not seen the documentation, so I'd like somebody to correct me on this if they have more information. You get a bus ticket out of town, or you can go to jail, which really is a sort of an example of the kind of nativist bigotry that we've seen in some other cities, and the Santa Cruz merchants have complained, they're sending all our people to Santa Cruz. They're sending their people. And this is the kind of, you know, the lament you've heard from some merchants now doing, well, at least this program is, if this is accurate, doing something similar. I again wonder if this is true. If it is, you know, it's more of the same bullshit, and it's exactly what I suspected they were trying to do. But, you know, one doesn't want to simply... you know, the facts are more important than one's suspicions or fears, so we need to know more about that. Let's take a musical break here, because I want to be... Oh, I'm going to take a musical break. You're not calling in, so I get to break. And I will remind you that if you do have tickets or want to help in the various HUF projects, we will be there, some of us, on Saturday at the Food Not Bombs meal. That's going to be uh, 4 o'clock on Saturday. So check it out.
Yeah.
Skidmark Bob, by the way, in case you were wondering who was singing. I've been down so fucking long, it looks like up to me. Here's something from the November 18th City Council, which is not the last City Council meeting. It was the council meeting before last, where there was some discussion of the stay-away order, increased powers to police, that comes up for a final reading on December 9th.
And ask questions directly and also kind of hear the presentation in that environment, I think will be really helpful to get more understanding of the...
This is the end of the prior agenda item.
Specifically housing, and some of it's also specifically other parts of what we do for low-income area serving needs. With that, I think you've been given a lot of direction from the council, and I thank you for your time, and I thank you for input from the community as well on this, and you'll have more chances.
Again, this is on input on HUD and CDBG funding. How should it be spent? Obviously not on such things as a low-income campground. I mean, that would be an utter waste of money, right? Although, of course, it would be a way of actually helping vast numbers of people and saving a lot of police department funding.
And quite a few of the comments that are more appropriate for oral communication. So as long as you can make sure your comments do go to the agenda item that is currently before us, that's the only reason, and it's unusual. This whole year, I don't think I've really had to stop anyone's comments, but tonight I've had to do it twice, I believe. So just as a reminder, and we will be going on.
This is Mayor Robinson, because she interrupted two speakers who were upset about the stay-away orders and talking about it on other issues, on other agenda items.
Ordinance amending section 13.08.100 of the Municipal Code pertaining to orders to vacate park property, and this will be, I believe, our Parks and Recs Director, Danette Shoemaker. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mayor and City Council. Police Chief Kevin Vogel is also available, as is Mauro Garcia and Heather Ryder, to answer any specific questions you might have. This is the first reading of an ordinance that we brought a similar reading to you back in October. And after that meeting, we received a letter from the ACLU that expressed some concerns about the proposed ordinance and especially the lack of an appeal process within the proposed ordinance. So we're back with you in front of you tonight to talk about our need for the ordinance and 13.08.100 of the Municipal Code.
And Danette is going to explain what it is, and boy, I said I wasn't going to do this, but this is an ordinance that would make it within the power of a police officer who gives any kind of infraction ticket to a person to issue a stay-away order as well, if she or he chooses to do so, before any kind of conviction or even charge is filed in court, and regardless of the outcome of that charge in court. So the stay-away order right now on the books is you can be told to stay away for a day from any area controlled by Parks and Rec, which is a large area, not just the parks, but areas of Pacific Avenue and other areas all over town, Poganep and so forth. The expansion of the law would allow any second infraction to require you to stay away for a week, both from the area where you got that infraction and any previous areas where you were given stay-away orders. The third would be a month. If you got a third infraction ticket and the cop chose to give you a stay-away with it, it would be for a month, the fourth for 6 months, the fifth for a year. And this, they patched up the ordinance when it was pointed out by the ACLU that it's unconstitutional for a variety of reasons. It gives unusual powers to the police officers to make kind of judgments as to who can be given these things and who can't. There's no real appeal process. And the appeal process means, what they did was they tacked on a process, an administrative process, that the city manager's office will appoint someone, and you can go to that person within 10 days before, presumably, your ticket actually gets to court, and you have to show you're innocent, or by a preponderance of the evidence, that the stay-away order is not justified. But since there's no criteria as to what, you know, what's going to prove that it wasn't justified, how come, you know, in half the tickets given in the last year, they gave stay-away orders and the other half they didn't, without any kind of reason or justification or standard for doing so? stay away orders that, again, didn't go through a court. Stay away orders usually mean, in the past they've always meant, you get an order from a court that requires you to stay away from the scene of a crime. Or a private business can certainly tell you, stay away from us. And I think they've recently, in the last 2 years, they used such a procedure in the library where they're giving stay away rules, which have never been taken to court. But the notion then you can ban people. I think they expanded this. The city council members justified it by saying, well, if they can order you to stay away from the library, we can order you to stay away from anywhere without any kind of court. Which, of course, insofar as you're dealing with public spaces, simply is not true. And it's horrendous if it's actually treated as true, and it's actually something that becomes part of the normal scene. Anyway, you're going to hear Dinette Shoemaker describing all the crimes that justify this. Actually, well, you be the judge.
Gives our rangers and police officers the ability to ask people who are cited for violations for illegal activity in our parks to stay away for 24 hours. That's the existing ordinance. What we're seeing is that we have quite a few repeat offenders, and we are hoping that if we can increase the stay away time, that we may get more compliance. We still have a lot of problems in our parks with illegal activities.
And two things here. Yes, they want to use this as a terror tactic rather than one they're enforcing that they get you to enforce on yourself. So in essence, to make you regard yourself as a criminal and keep away from areas that you have a perfect right to be in. This is part of the general scheme of law enforcement and the laws in Santa Cruz. Generally, they don't have the person power or the jail space to really enforce this kind of stuff if people challenged it. But if they get you sufficiently scared, then they can get you to leap through these hoops, avoid these areas, act in very domesticated ways, and essentially deny basic human needs, such as sleep at night, the most obvious need. And they don't have to expend any resources. All they got to do is pass laws. I guess that's part of the theory behind this. The second thing is you're going to hear her use the phrase illegal behavior again and again. What she won't tell you, and what the city council ignores when we bring it up, is an elaborate and exhaustive analysis of all citations in the last year have shown that the majority of them, I might even say the overwhelming majority, I think it's more than 60%, are for the following kinds of, quote, illegal behavior. Sleeping, being in a park after dark, or smoking. That's the illegal behavior that will ban you from these areas for not just for a night, but for a week, a month, 6 months, a year, when this law comes back, if it passes on the 9th of December.
And this includes black people, Latino people, white people.
But it's probably mainly white people it's going to impact in Santa Cruz. Although we did find that Officer Barnett downtown, when he was issuing citations, he gave out 10% of his citations to folks of African-American visage. African-Americans make up 1.4% of the county. So he's ticketing them at a rate of 7 times their prevalence in the county. Now, they may be concentrated downtown, or there may be a lot of black people downtown. I haven't seen that many black people occasionally. Or they may be natural criminals, which, of course, seems to be the PR job being done on the drug war and the reason for this great, massive, and very profitable expansion of the prison industry over the last 3 decades. But, yeah, racial profiling is an issue. Let's hear some more of Dinette.
I've been CC'd on several letters that have come to you just over the last few days, in particular about Garfield Park, San Lorenzo Park, Harvey West Park. What parents and grandparents are expressing concern about are very similar to the concerns that are expressed by our staff within the parks daily. It's illegal activity. People selling drugs, using drugs, urinating and defecating.
The citations issued for those crimes were minuscule, less than 4 or 5% of citations. using drugs, selling drugs, urinating, or defecating. Of course, there is the reality that there are no open bathrooms at night, although there could be, because open bathrooms are available in some of these large parks, particularly, for example, San Lorenzo Park. The city chooses to close them and then start denouncing people for crapping in the bushes. I mean, it's kind of convenient if you want to, you know, ramp up anti-homeless hysteria, but it's obviously economically stupid. It's being done for a political purpose. Mike, you wanted to say something, I think?
Well, what I just wanted to say was this lady has a salary of over $200,000 a year. It's unnecessary for any job in the city to have that kind of a salary. Unnecessary.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, she and the city manager get a lot of bucks, and probably even more in pensions and other perks, although I don't know what the stats are for that. What I do know is that this was primarily presented in its earlier incarnation, because she had an earlier law that they brought forward, and then they pulled back because the ACLU issued a, you know, there's no appeal process, and they tacked on this, you know, in-house appeal process that has nothing to do with any real legal standards or anything of that sort, and gives you no real clarity of defense as written. They added something onto it when it came to the city council on November 18th as well, saying you can prove by a preponderance of the evidence, which is a standard which means 51% of the evidence, that this stay-away order was not necessary. How the hell can you do that? I'm not sure. Then the administrative officer shall dismiss the charge. Although that's not written into the law, that's what the city attorney said was in the law implicitly, or he was adding to it. I'm not quite sure. The problem is, of course, in court, they have to prove, not just by a preponderance of the evidence, not by just by clear and convincing evidence, which requires more evidence. They have to prove by beyond a reasonable doubt that you are guilty of the crime. So the standard is much looser, and you'll be punished, really punished, by essentially being denied access to the parks. And for poor and homeless people, that is a serious matter. The parks that you were specifically told to stay away from. Not all parks, it was pointed out, no, until they go after you in those parks. And then it'll be those parks, too. Let's hear some more about the illegal activities. And again, this is Dinette Shoemaker, who before spoke a lot about how, you know, a wedding party was called off because people were nervous about homeless people in the parks. This pretext has been used, or this reason has been used repeatedly in the last two or three decades here. You'll see it a lot online. It's a lot like the sort of the class equivalent of racism. It is a form of fear and stereotyping and smearing a whole group with the bad experiences or the things you've heard about bad experiences with homeless folks or the realities of homeless life that you don't want to face and you don't want to address. Maybe it scares you. Maybe, you know, you'd prefer to see everything neat and clean and trim and good, and perhaps they would too. I don't know. But that is not the reality, and because it's not the reality, you're going to make sure it's driven away from your neck of the woods. And call it crime, and you get people excited about it and start screaming about needles, even though you haven't got, you know, a decent program for inhalation therapy.